WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Gloria Steinem is not only a tireless leader of the feminist movement and co-founder of Ms. Magazine, but in the mainstream press, her name has been almost synonymous with feminism. After years of writing about the political, social, and economic barriers to women's rights, Gloria Steinem has now written about one of the inner barriers that holds many women back, low self-esteem. Her new book, Revolution from Within, was first inspired by the kind of women she so often met on the road, women who were smart and courageous, yet very insecure, the kind of women who, in spite of their accomplishments, would preface their opinions with phrases like, "I don't know, maybe it's only me, but..." Steinem then began reading the many self-help books for women. She was disappointed to find they dealt only with internal change, without addressing the need for a social revolution. So she began writing her own book.
I sat down and wrote, you know, some 200-300 pages of repertorial philosophical prose and showed it to a friend who said, you know, "I don't know how to tell you this, but you have a self-esteem problem you forgot to put yourself in." Before I began to even get a glimmer of realizing that I was, of course, as we so often do, writing what we need to read and teaching what we need to learn, and that, in fact, a lot of pressures had come to a focus at the same point in my life, the loss of Ms. Magazine, just the of course, it's back again now, but I mean, you know, I'm talking about 1987, the sheer tiredness of 20 years of being flat-out activist in a kind of unbalanced way, and the realization that I was repeating in adulthood a pattern of neglect. I know that sounds corny. I don't know how else to say it. But, you know, you do go on treating yourself often as you were treated as a child. But I just hadn't realized that. You know, if I didn't take care of myself or choose to own very much or save money, I thought it was a conscious decision. And it took me some real crises to understand that I was treating myself the way I had been treated in childhood. It just all came together at the time that I realized I'd written the wrong book. And so the book became a very personal journey. It's only about 20% personal, I suppose, but still a very personal journey as well as a repertorial one.
Do you think that what you had been lacking was time for a personal life or self-esteem? They're two different things. They might be related, but they're basically different.
Well, I think if you have a strong sense of what I would call core self-esteem, you take time for yourself and you draw limits and you realize you need sustenance. And I had a picture of myself as two things: one, less real than other people, because which is very typical of neglected children. You know, this wasn't my parents' fault. They were doing the best they could, but still, you know, I had not gone to school and, you know, many other things when I was growing up. And also I'd taken care of my mother, who was an invalid much of the time. So I thought of myself as a caretaker. You know, I was not the one with problems. I was the one who helped other people. And that was just so entrenched that I couldn't think of myself any other way and take time for myself.
You said that you felt less real than other people. I'm wondering if you felt that your sense of who you were and your sense of self-esteem was different in your professional life than in your personal life. If you had more faith in yourself as like Gloria Steinem, feminist, than as Gloria Steinem, you know, a person at home.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's sort of the same thing, really, because the form it takes is that you believe your inner life is not as real as the outer world, and therefore you make yourself real by being useful. And, you know, it's the source of workaholism, classically. Now, it happened that I was lucky to be part of a movement that gave me life and that was connected to my life. It wasn't as if I was making widgets, you know. I care and continue to care deeply about what I was doing, but I was just I had got totally out of balance, so that the internal, you know, it isn't, I think, that our internal life is more or less real. It's that it's as real as the external life, and I just was nowhere near close to realizing that.
You don't want us to read your book as Gloria Steinem recants her dedication to the women's movement.
Oh, heavens no.
She realizes she would have been better off with a traditional life.
Oh, my goodness, no. I mean, I would have been, you know, totally, no, the movement gave me life and continues to give me life. It's absolutely not. And I'm very grateful and very happy for very much of what I was able to be part of. On the contrary, the thing is, I think I would have been a more effective activist if I'd had a better grounding in childhood or been able to go back and figure out why I didn't have a better grounding, because it made me, for instance, very scared of conflict, likely to confuse motion with action, you know, just to keep going for the sake of going. It made me a less effective activist, and I hope and believe that when we look inward and strengthen ourselves, we get more effective on the outside.
Are there things that you feel women friends of yours have or have had that you now wish you had as well?
For instance?
Well, personal life type of things, marriage, children.
Oh no. Mm-mm. No, because I mean... Not in those forms. I mean, if you said to me, did I miss having a home? Yes, I did miss having a home. But
you mean physically a home?
Physically a home, because a home is a kind of symbol of the self. And I think a lot of single women felt somewhere inside, I guess, that you were not supposed to make a home except unless you were making it for other people. And also, it was redoubled for me because I hadn't had a home when I was a child, so I didn't know how to do it. But I think the inner life and home and love and closeness and intimacy, we all need those things, but we all need them in particular and very different ways. I mean, I had, thanks to the movement, been able to find chosen family, that is, people who shared values, mostly other women, you know, but some men too, who became literally family because of the intensity of the work that we were doing together. And that was a great gift.
I ask about, if you changed your mind about mm-hmm. marriage and children, because I think that for women a little younger than you, there are so few women to look around at and say, well, how do they feel? They've made mm-hmm. the decision to either be single or to not have children, you know, as they get older, do they still think it was a good choice, or do they regret it? What's ahead when you look down the line? So that's why I'm asking you that.
No, I understand that, and I, you know, we're all looking at each other's lives,
right,
trying to figure out
exactly
how to live. And all I can say is that it's I feel great joy in this path that I've chosen. I mean, we don't have to give birth to someone to nurture them. And I'm happy with those choices.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gloria Steinem. She's written a new book called Revolution from Within, a book of self-esteem. You were diagnosed with breast cancer in 1986. You had a lumpectomy, and that really did the trick. It never came,
yeah, so far,
came back, thank goodness. Yeah.
Yeah, so far I'm fine, and I have mixed feelings about, I always feel I have to explain my experience with breast cancer because so many other women have had so much more horrendous experiences than I have.
Yeah.
And yet when the word cancer comes into your life in whatever form, it really does have a great impact. And it was very important to me, you know, because it made me realize several things. One was, this may sound strange if I try to say it short, but that actually, I was less afraid of dying than of aging, or not of aging exactly. I didn't know how to enter the last third of life because there were so few role models. Because when I first heard this diagnosis, I thought, ironically, oh, so that's how it's going to end, you know. And then I thought to myself, as if it was welling up from the deepest part of me, I've had a wonderful life. And I treasure that moment, you know. It meant a lot to me. But on the other hand, it also made me realize that in this culture, women, we know how to be in the central plateau of life. And I'd been there a terrifically long time because I'd become a grown-up too early because my mother being an invalid. So from about 10 to 52 or so, I'd been in this central plateau. Now I was entering a whole new place. It was like falling off a cliff because I couldn't see enough people ahead of me. You know, in the last two or three years of really, how shall I say, of kind of paying more attention to my own inner life, I've realized that this aging in the last third of life or whatever is a new country. I now actually feel excited about it because you, as Carolyn Heilbrun has pointed out so brilliantly in Writing a Woman's Life, women become ourselves after 50. You know, we leave behind this female impersonator role and drop a lot of baggage and really become much more our true selves.
You know what I find particularly interesting about hearing you thinking about the latter part of your life is that I think for a lot of women, it's the end of your life where you're supposed to be punished for the freedoms that you've taken during the first parts of your life. You know, like if you've decided to be independent or, you know, not be married or not have children or something, you're punished for that in the end because you're supposed to look forward to an old age where you're lonely, you're alone, there's no one to be with, no one to take care of you. I mean, I think that's been really instilled in all of
mm-hmm,
us.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's sort of the secular version of hell, I think. and like the religious version of hell, it has nothing to do with real life.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, that's always been clearly to me part of the backlash. You know, I just don't believe that. I mean, you know, if you've done the best you can. I mean, what's so wonderful about being dependent in the last third of life when you're a grown up, when it was difficult enough when you were a child. You know, and but I just think we need to think about what we want to do. It's suddenly ideas of dependency and being taken care of re-enter our heads because that's the only model for old age we have. But we're inventing new models. I remember that Tish Summers, the late Tish Summers, you know, had a wonderful group called the Last Perch, which were older women, each of whom you know, was part of a community and a kind of chosen family to grow old together. You know, and I love the name anyway, The Last Perch. I thought that was
great. Yeah,
yeah. You know, we need to let our imaginations roam in new ways. Probably we are on the edge of history. This may be the first time that there has been a very big age cohort, as the sociologists say, of women who have a tradition of independence and who are living longer. And since women grow more radical with age, as we know, our pattern of activism is the reverse of men's. I don't mean all men and all women, of course. I'm sure listeners understand that. But in general, because women lose power as they get older and men gain power, then the activism goes in the other direction. So I have this vision of an army of gray-haired women taking over the earth. You know, this may become the kind of red-hot center of feminist revolution precisely because there are more women with greater tradition of independence and greater in number and living longer who can take advantage of this fact of growing more radical with age.
An interesting vision. My guest is Gloria Steinem. She's written a new book called Revolution from Within, a Book of Self-Esteem. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Gloria Steinem is my guest. In your new book, in the parts that are personal, you write a little bit about a relationship that you had in the 80s that didn't work out. You don't mention the name of the book, but I think a lot of people already know that it was with the real estate developer.
No, I don't think they do know.
Oh.
Because I have never indicated who it was, and if I'd wanted people to know who it was, I would have written. There are two stories in that chapter, and I don't say who either one of them are.
Okay, it's been mentioned in magazines, but you still...
But that's their problem.
All right. Mm-hmm. as you write in the book, you fell in love with someone who you felt was obviously wrong for you. And you read in the book that you relied on your skill of getting a man to fall in love with you, but you got him to fall in love with the inauthentic you. Mm-hmm. So you had to keep on not being yourself in order to keep the relationship going. And I was really wondering, what were the parts of your personality that rose to the surface that you saw as not being yourself during this relationship?
That's a good question, because it's sort of hard to identify. I think it was really just resting in a way, you know, not feeling that I had to be a caretaker. I mean, I felt at last here was somebody who was so strong that I didn't have to take care of him, and it was at a moment in which I felt I was taking care of the earth, you know. What I didn't realize was that I was looking for, I was missing strength in myself. I'd allowed myself to become very weakened, so I was projecting onto him or looking to him for what I needed myself. And so I let go by all kinds of differences in values, which normally I would have understood was a problem for any friendship.
The person who you were in a relationship with was very, very wealthy and had a lot of business interests. And I was wondering if that relationship caused anyone close to you or anyone who just knew you from your books and from your kind of public work, if it made them question your politics because of your affiliation with him. And if so, what your reaction to that was?
Yeah, I think it did. It probably made them question my you know, I mean, nobody understood it, right? It made me defiant. Do you know what I mean? You know how it is when somebody questions a choice of yours. Sometimes it makes you all the more determined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it had that impact on me for a while.
And I've read that you're not in a relationship now for the first time since you were 21. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. It shows you what a 50s person I am, even though.
Well, what do you like and not like about being single now? Or, you know, being not in a relationship?
Uh-huh. Well, I haven't come to the point yet where I find something that I don't like about it, which means that it's still a choice. You know, I may come to the point at which I find something. But right now I feel like I'm doing something that I should have done when I was a teenager or in my 20s or, you know, because there's a kind of a joy and a freedom that comes from making your own schedule, not worrying about somebody else's friends, not having to apologize because you have a deadline and you have to cancel something. It doesn't mean that I haven't in the past taken great pleasure and learned a great deal from the people I've been close to and loved. It's just that I'm experiencing a different kind of pleasure now.
In your book, Revolution from Within, you write a little bit about your own self-image. And in the book, you describe yourself as a foodaholic. And you say your father was 300 pounds. And you write, "I'm not a thin woman. I'm a fat woman who's not fat at the moment."
Mm-hmm, right.
Do you see yourself as having an eating disorder?
Well, you know, that's such a label now. It's hard to know. I think we're all, given the culture and what it does to our pictures of women's bodies, where it's the eating disorders are a continuum. You know, I was never bulimic in the sense of vomiting and so on. I would never do that, nor was I ever anorexic in any way. But I was enough addicted to food so that I couldn't keep food in my house, and I was especially addicted to sugar and so on. So, you know, it's a continuum. And if you feel a kind of emptiness inside, you try, or if you feel unacceptable emotions welling up, anger and things that women aren't supposed to experience, you stuff it down with food. You know, this is certainly the understanding of women who have come forth and helped each other in eating disorder groups.
Well, I think it's interesting for you as a feminist to say to other women that your thinness, which so many women admire and envy, comes out of something that you see as a problem.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's important to say that. You know, the book was published in England first, so I went there first, and it was real hard to talk about all this in the land of the stiff upper lip, you know. So I'm glad to be talking to you. But one woman actually said to me, well, as a leader, whatever that means, I mean, I would object to that, but anyway, of the women's movement, aren't you betraying other women by talking about your, you know, inner problems and processes and so on? And I didn't know what to say to her. Finally, I said, well, in that case, all leaders should betray us. You know, because unless, you know, it doesn't do us any good, you know, to think that somebody else is another species and doesn't share the same experiences. In fact, I put Gandhi in this book as a personal story, a personal parable of his growing up and childhood and, you know, the first half of his life, because I think seeing him as the saint he's portrayed doesn't help us, but because I lived in India, I got to realize that he had spent the first half of his life as this, you know, very, very insecure, you know, imitative, conformist person who you know, went to England to be trained as a barrister and wore pinstripe suits and wing collars and tried desperately to learn how to foxtrot and play the violin and speak French and so on, until he finally realized that the bias against Indians on the part of the British in South Africa, in his case, was so complete that no amount of conformism to his false self was going to get him anywhere. He might as well be his true self. And that became his strength. Now, that makes me much better able to learn from him than I ever was before. I love the idea that he was once this gawky guy, you know, in a pinstripe suit trying to foxtrot.
In trying to find more time for your private life, for yourself, what have you given up in terms of your more public life?
Well, I'm just beginning this book tour now, and I think maybe what I've given up is a certain amount of ability to function on automatic pilot. Do you know what I mean? It's like I feel I now have more nerve endings than I did. I feel more. That means you feel both more pain and more joy, or, you know, to be corny about it, but it's true, you know. So I may not be able to get back into that automatic pilot mode. I'm not sorry that I can't, if you know what I mean. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's progress, but it does mean you have to think differently and schedule yourself differently.
Well, good luck on the road.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Gloria Steinem, and she's written a new book called Revolution from Within, A Book of Self-Esteem. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.